suicide numbers worldwide have ratcheted upward. From societal pressures surrounding economic crisis, wars, bullying, and disconnected lives. Death by suicide reaches into every age and socioeconomic and ethnic group and has become so widespread that most people know someone who has been touched by suicide. In its wake, survivors are left with a trail of uncertainty. Our guest today is Dr. Adele McDowell. And Dr. McDowell has written a book called Making Peace with Suicide. It's a book of hope, understanding, and comfort. And Adele finally lifts the taboo surrounding suicide to uncover the many facets of this sensitive topic. She says, sheds light on today's global epidemic suicide and provides a roadmap for survivors struggling to overcome guilt and grief. Dr. McDowell is a psychologist, a teacher, a writer who liked looking at life through the big viewfinder. She specializes in transformational work using psychoneuroimmunology, and that's also known as mind-body medicine. She uses energy medicine, as well as cognitive, behavioral, transpersonal, and positive psychologies. So it's our pleasure today to have a real expert on the topic of suicide. And Adele, it's great to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you so much, Wynn. I'm honored to be here.
Okay, so do you want to tell us how you got into suicide?
Okay, I will. I would tell you the most immediate answer is that I had a colleague that I knew from a conference in California. I attended the conference maybe every other year, and I'm on the East Coast. And I got a phone call from some mutual friends telling me that Susan had died, and they were all hemming and hawing. And I said, what do you mean? So I just sent her an email for her 65th birthday, and I knew stuff that had gone on in her family. I said, what are you talking about? And they hemmed and hawed, and finally said, well, maybe it was a suicide. And as a result of that, I wrote an article called The Psychologist Suicide. And then one day, I'm at the kitchen sink doing dishes, and whatever you want to call that little voice that you hear that says, Adele, it's time for you to write a book on suicide. I really had not thought about writing the book until that moment, and I do listen to the little voice when I hear it. And then I realized that everything I had done in my life up to this point had brought me here. And I thought, wow, okay. And I started writing the book, and I will tell you, in the beginning, it was like crawling over broken glass and barbed wire. It was very painful and depleting. And then as I got deeper into the work, I just realized there was a bigger picture. And whether you want to call it spiritual, big viewfinder, whatever, that there was a bigger picture. And I believe suicide teaches us all a profound lesson of compassion, and it is a societal issue. There are many factors, as you mentioned in the intro, but it's a huge social epidemic and requires a lot of compassion from a lot of places.
Absolutely. You have said that there are 10 things that you wish everyone would understand about suicide. Can we go over those?
Sure. Well, absolutely.
First one is suicide is pervasive.
Absolutely. And suicide is indeed pervasive. It is, everyone knows someone equally. Many of us have had the thought, even if it's for an abstract moment. I had a mother who was suicidal as well as being alcoholic, and those things definitely go together. And so everybody knows somebody. I was working in corporate America, and I got somebody runs down the hall and comes grabs me, and they say, they'll come quick, and someone had cut her wrist with a broken glass. I'm in freshman year in college, and somebody comes and grabs me and says, someone has cut their wrist. It is pervasive all over the place. Every culture, every society, every social strata.
Yes. Before we get into the second point, I just want for you to make the association between addiction and suicide, because, as you know, I've been doing addiction for 30 years, and I know that there's some kind of connection. Tell me about it.
Yeah, absolutely, and I was so excited that we were going to talk together because I thought we would move to this place. You know that with adolescents, I think the number is 60 or 70% of all adolescent, teenage to young adults, that age gravens, the number two means of death for that age group is suicide. And it's 67, 70% of all of those suicides are related to some kind of substance abuse, be it alcohol or drugs, right? And for you, when you look at both suicidal folks and addicts may feel difficulty with their feelings, anger and anxiety, you know, damaged. They may not feel like they're worth anything. There's depression and despair and heartache and misunderstood and disconnected and shame and guilt and all of those things. And for people who are suicidal, the use of substances can lower the threshold. It can make you more impulsive. For some people, when they use, they become very angry, and suicide can certainly be the ultimate FU. It can make you emotionally scattered, and your thinking not clear, and so it can lead you there. And people who have been chronic substance abusers and alcoholics who have gotten to a place where they, despite repeated attempts at recovery or rehab or treatment or anything, they're stuck in a place. They're intractable. Their emotions are shut down. Their mental processes are not what they used to be. And I can look at advanced addiction as a slow form of suicide.
Right. That brings up the topic of Robin Williams.
It does.
What can you tell our listeners about Robin Williams' suicide?
Well, I'll tell you, since I started talking about the book, I went and did some research on Robin Williams, because we know that he suffered from depression and some addiction, alcohol, and I believe cocaine issues, and that he had put himself in a recovery program. I think it was Hazelton, but I could be mistaken. Anyway, it turns out, though, when they did the autopsy, that they found out that he had Lewy's protein, which indicated that the Parkinson diagnosis that he had was accurate, and that the Lewy's protein, and you know this better than I do, it indicates a kind of dementia that's associated with Parkinson. So in his particular case, unlike Philip Seymour Hoffman, in his particular case, there was an organic physical reason that led him to that place. Apparently he had increased anxiety, which is why he moved out of the bedroom with his wife, because he couldn't sleep, and his brain was going all over the place. So per the coroner's report, you know, we look at that. But we also know that he was having some difficulties up to that moment and had relapsed on his hard-won sobriety. And all of those things, as you know, everything impacts everything. And we look at Philip Seymour Hoffman, and I believe he died from an overdose of heroin after many, many years of clean and sober living. And there certainly must have been a cluster of stressors that led him to that place. He was on the peak of, he was a very successful actor, but I think he was on the peak of even more success, right?
Right. Well, the thing about heroin is you never know what you're getting, and even if you expected a certain result, sometimes you get more than what you thought you were.
Oh, that's so true. When I was working at a drug clinic with vets who had just come home from Vietnam, and I'm sure you know this, when they were in Vietnam, they had some available pure grade kind of heroin, and then when they came home, there was a synthetic rash of stuff called P-dope, and with constant use of P-dope, it ended up mimicking the symptoms of Parkinson's.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, let's get back to the 10 things that you want everybody to know about suicide. And
okay.
The second thing is risk factors are on the rise.
They are. And one thing I forgot to mention is, because I think the statistics are startling, World Health Organization, WHO, tells us that there is, on average, one suicide every 40 seconds in the U.S., around the world, rather. And in the U.S., there is one suicide every 13 minutes. And attempted suicides, the numbers go up exponentially. And depending who you read, you can multiply that by 2, 4, 5, or 20.
Wow.
So that is pretty amazing. Now, risk factors, when I'm looking at cumulative stressors and traumatic events, we've got economic issues. We have a lot of suicide by economic crisis. I think it was Greece, Italy, and Ireland just started suicide hotlines in the last few years because of the large numbers of suicide by economic crisis. We have family history, whether it's mental illness, there's been a suicidality in the family, substance abuse, violence. And also the Harvard School of Public Health tells us that if you have a gun in your house, there is a higher incidence of suicide. And I think that speaks to availability. And physical issues, we had talked about with Robin Williams with organic brain disease, traumatic brain injury, the things we see with the combat soldiers, and then the NFL football players. Are one of the guys, Dave Duerson, took his life. He shot himself in the heart instead of the head and left a note, please, please, please examine my brain. Because he has something called chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, and that increased depression, which increased suicidality, and they examined his brain and saw that there were organic issues there. And, of course, we have the psychological pain that you think of the kids who get bullied, right, and unabated fear or terror can make you do terrible things because you just want to get out of that pain. There's guilt, there's shame, there's abandonment, there's so many things, right? There we've got the social issues, and of course we have trauma, whether you're being bullied, you're a combat soldier, you have been a victim of childhood sexual abuse, natural disasters. All of these factors, all of these clusters of events can take you to a place, a tipping point, where it becomes very binary. Life is black and white, and you think, what choice do I have? If you don't have a home, if you don't have a job, if you feel that you're not worth anything, if you feel disconnected from others, you will posit the question, what am I doing here, right?
Right. We're talking today with Adele McDowell. Dr. McDowell has written a book called Making Peace with Suicide. It's a book of hope and understanding and comfort. Adele, how did they get a copy of your book?
Well, thanks for asking, Wynn. You can go to Amazon.com or you can go to the book's website, MakingPeaceWithSuicide.com.
Okay. Now, we're going to get back to the 10 things that you wanted our listeners to know, and we're going to try to get through them if possible. The third point is survivors of a suicidal loss can become suicidal as well.
That's right, because the trauma of the suicide, whether you have witnessed it or imagined it, the taboo has been broken, and it's complicated grief, because when you lose someone to suicide, it's not like you've lost your beloved grandmother at 102 and she had a full life. It's often shocking or surprising or the result of some chronic mental health issues. So it's traumatic for the survivor, and they often are judged and treated poorly. The world is getting a little bit better, but one mom told me the story of, she went back to work, and they said, well, if you didn't work, your son wouldn't have done this. If you didn't have a gun in the house, your son wouldn't have done this. If you had just seen the signs. And she said, I just thought he was being a normal teenager. I didn't see it. He went to school. He had a job. He was in sports. I didn't see it. And her daughter went back to school, and this was many, many years ago. And the kids didn't know how to talk to her, and the teachers avoided their daughter. Her teachers avoided because they didn't know what to say, right?
That's rough. The fourth point, suicide is universal.
Right, and as we've talked, each and every one of us has known someone who has either taken the act or thought of the act, and possibly even any of us listening, you know, have held the thought, even in the abstract, in their hands for a minute.
Okay. Number five, suicide has many faces.
That's right. It's a tipping point of pain or shame. It's a plea for help. It's a response to mental illness and haywire neurochemistry. Suicide can be the last gasp of despair and resignation. It can be a consequence of hopelessness and isolation. It can be an impulsive mistake, a planned ending of life, a shredded soul, the ultimate act of rage or fury, collateral damage from violence and trauma. And as we know, I also think suicide is a huge lesson of compassion for all of us.
Yes. Number six, please don't say committed suicide.
I know. You were so good. You did not say it in the beginning. When you didn't say it, and that's rare, because for people who've lost someone, it's considered insensitive, and suicide used to be considered illegal. It isn't in the Western world, and you know, assisted suicide, of course, is another topic, but it's no longer appropriate. So you might say, you know, died by suicide instead.
Yes. Number seven, suicide is not an act of cowardice.
Right. Wait, if you and I were in the same room, right, and I go to you and I put a pillow over your face, I'm sure you're going to fight with me and say, what do you think you're doing? Because our instinct is to fight for life. Suicide happens for a lot of reasons, and I don't think cowardice is one of them. Pain, to me, in any shape or form, is the predominant catalyst.
Right. Number eight, soul loss contributes to suicide.
Absolutely. And there was, I was told by a colleague from Ireland that during what they call the Troubles in Ireland, the one gentleman shot his neighbor because they were on opposing sides, Catholic versus Protestant. And he shot his neighbor, and he said at that moment he felt his soul leave his body, and he could not live with it, and he later took his own life. I think, and when with all of your work in addiction, I'm sure you see this, that people are not living their full lives, whether we're reactive to people around us, we don't know who we are, or we get stuck in that robotic kind of thing, and we don't stop, right? Somebody just sent me an email of someone who had been working crazily for a number of months and was taking a vacation, got to the airport, went flying over something in long-term parking and banged up their face. And they just said, and the paramedics said, we're going to take you to the hospital. They're like, no, you can't take me to the hospital. I have to get on the plane. You know, we don't stop and listen and feed our souls. We have many robotic lives. People, you know, on the East Coast years ago, there was a commercial. I think it was Dunkin' Donuts. And you'd see the baker, and you'd see the clock, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and you hear him say, time to make the donuts, right? Like, here we go, back on the hamster wheel. And I think we need to feed our souls. I think we have to have a connection with something bigger than ourselves, whether you call it nature or God or mystery or whatever it is. I think living meaningful lives, speaking to your question number three of your four questions, we need to feed our souls. I think we'd all be much happier and there'd be far fewer suicides.
Right. Number nine, the majority of suicides do not leave a note.
Yeah, that's correct. It's depending, you know, the research varies, 25 to 35% leave a note, and the notes are different varieties. For people who are very mentally ill and their thinking is scattered and chaotic, when I asked their loved ones, they all used the same word, the exact same word. They said the note was gibberish, right, reflecting the mental state of their loved one. Other people would leave notes. Remember the actor Freddie Prinze? He left a note, something to the effect like it's nobody's fault. You know, or people will leave, you know, do this for my mother or give this to my daughter, that kind of thing, housekeeping kind of thing. But often when people are in that place, they're not, They've gone beyond thinking of other people. They think what people have been on the edge have said to me. I want them to forget me as soon as possible. I don't want them to think about me. I want them to get on with their lives. And they're so busy thinking about what they're going to do that many don't. One man I was working with, happily he is still alive, but he had been very suicidal. In fact, sent me a picture of him on top of a bridge in New York City. And we worked through all of this stuff, and I said to him at one point, what I'd like you to do, your thinking is such, I said, I would like you to make sure you write some letters to your children. He said, well, you'll explain it. I said, that's not going to be enough. You know, you need to, and he said to me, I can't do this. And so the exercise actually worked for me. I wanted it to work therapeutically, but it's very hard for people to tell their loved ones what they, because they don't want to cause them pain, and they feel guilty for causing them pain.
I was going through the checkout line at Walmart yesterday, and the tabloid said Robin Williams left a note. Did you hear anything about that?
No, I didn't. Did he get anything else about it? I'll have to look it up.
I didn't take time to read the article.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, and I wonder how that fits. I wonder about the note given the coroner's report about the thing with the dementia.
Yeah.
I'll have to look it up and check it out.
Okay, and the last point, number 10, if a loved one is feeling suicidal.
Uh-huh. And if a loved one is feeling suicidal, first you want to establish safety, right? You know, if there's a knife or a gun or whatever, that can be put to the side. You know, you want to, you have to speak to them from the heart. You need to speak truth, right? And my main thing is insert a pause where there's some hope. There's some possibility. We can talk about resources. We can look at things. Often when people are suicidal, their thinking is so tight and constricted, right? It's just black and white. And they go, well, what about this? Or we could consider that. Or we could do this. Or we could do that. When I was in college, I worked on the first suicide, they called it paraprofessional at that time. It had only been psychiatrists, hotline in the country, right? I'm at New York Hospital, Cornell Division, and I'm working on the hotline, and the methodology then was to have the call traced and to send the police, you know. Now I always felt so guilty not telling, and I only talked to them, they were the only ones who called, I never could tell them the truth because they would run, and you didn't want them to run and to hurt themselves. But often if somebody calls the hotline number, right, they're looking for possibility or hope. And I'll just give that hotline number while we're talking, and it's 1-800-273-8255, 1-800-273-8255, 24/7. And because sometimes you need a connection. Research will say there are three common reasons for suicide. One, mental health. Two, substance abuse. Three, the combination of mental health and substance abuse. Now, okay, I look at it, I break it down a little bit differently, but I see three common elements. And one is pain, and any kind, physical, emotional, mental, whatever. One is pain. Two is disconnection. And you may have loved ones, but you don't feel the connection because you yourself are shut down, right? And the third is, I call disenfranchisement, which is disconnection to the nth degree. And you feel like you are there, you have no value, you have no worth, you're looking at the world through, like through a glass, looking at everybody else. You don't feel tethered or connected at all. And I think that's what happens when people become suicidal. Now, I'd add a proviso with the young people, right? When we get the young people, their brains aren't formed, and they can be very, very impulsive, right?
Right. You have 7 steps to make peace with suicide, and I don't think that we have time to go into each of them by themselves, but when the listeners today buy your book, Making Peace with Suicide, and they get it on at Amazon, they will find out about these 7 steps. But I'm just going to list them quickly. Tell your story, own your part, debrief the dark moments, call back your spirit. What are the lessons? Connect with your loved ones. Make a commitment to peace. These are how you can make peace with suicide, and you can learn about them in the book. We're right at the tail end of the program, Adele. I want you to tell the people, what is your mission in life?
Oh, I love that question, Wynn. It's an easy one for me. My mission in life is to be of service.
Great, and the way that you're doing this is very remarkable, and I honor you for it. This is a great book, Making Peace with Suicide. Go get a copy.
And thank you so much, Wynn.
Thank you, Adele, for being on the program today.
Thank you.